Coming to you live from the bridge of the Starship Enterprise. My name's Tom, and with me, as always, is some sort of green space lady. And this is the Mildly Alarming Podcast. Episode 32.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Johannes Stauffer.
And I'm Tom.
And he would have been ready to tell us what his name was if he would not be dicking around on the internet with Hero Forge. Maybe close that now and we can record a podcast.
In my defense, I made kind of a pudgy dude with like long flowing hair and he looked really goofy.
There's no defense.
You're wrong. If done right, no can defense. Is that the right reference?
I have no idea.
It's the Karate Kid, isn't it?
Sure. I don't know. I don't know if I've ever even actually seen the Karate Kid.
You know,
all the way
now
through.
That I bring it up, I don't know that I have either.
Yeah.
Doesn't he win by kicking a guy in the face, even though there's like a rule in the tournament that you can't kick to the face?
As previously mentioned, I don't think I've even seen the Karate Kid all the way
through. Well, perhaps we should end this podcast and watch the Karate Kid.
All right.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everyone. But actually, I don't want to watch the Karate Kid, which is why I haven't even seen it all the way through. Probably, maybe.
Didn't they do a version of it with Jaden Smith a couple years ago?
Yeah, apparently he was really good. I think he trained with... Because what is his name? I'm totally blanking. Every Kung Fu movie most people have watched.
Chow Yun-Fat.
Jackie Chan.
That's a different person.
Yeah. Apparently Jackie Chan was Mr. Miyagi in the new one. And actually trained Jaden Smith for the film and... said something along the lines of, like, if he were able to stay here for, you know, 10 years or however long, he could be a better martial artist than I am. Like, he actually has a lot of promise, but then they didn't, and now he's that guy who posts weird crap on Twitter, and that's the only thing he's famous for.
He does post weird crap on Twitter.
Really weird crap. So, anyway, I didn't see that one either, but I read that thing because I like Jackie Chan.
You do like Jackie Chan. We should get him on the show.
Yeah, he'd probably just be all about that. Coming out here to rural Michigan and recording a low-quality podcast about board games.
I see no reason why that wouldn't happen. So about board games, we were going to talk today about the game design process, how our different creative styles function together, how we bring the rich, lustrous peanut butter that is my brilliance and combine it with the thick-set... hirsute chocolate is Johannes's technical capability and produce board gaming greatness thereof.
What kind of chocolate do you eat?
Your chocolate doesn't have hair?
No. That's disgusting.
Fair enough.
I was going to comment on the... What did you call it? Not luxurious. What did you call the peanut butter? It was also a hair reference.
Was it?
Yeah.
I don't remember now.
Yeah, gross. You eat bad candy.
So, creative process, board game development, how one goes about making board games. So it's been kind of an interesting ride these 17 and a half years since we started Mildly Alarming Games and started trying to make games together, in figuring out how to merge our different creative processes. Because I would describe mine as primarily laziness with a light dusting of sloth.
And I would describe mine as waiting sort of like some kind of hidden predator for someone else to do something creative and then telling them why it's bad and how it could be better.
My feelings are hurt on a regular basis.
I do what I can.
Just routinely. But that kind of distills down our creative process. I make a thing which may or may not be good, And then Johannes tells me the ways in which it is bad.
And on very rare occasion, I make a thing and Tom doesn't know what to do with it because that's not how his creative process functions.
It's very true. I have no clue. He emails it to me and I'm like, I don't even know what these words mean.
That seems like a thing, I guess.
It's here and now I have it and I don't know what to do with it.
We're at the point with WikiSleuth where just some raw creativity needs to go into it to make some cards and make a game that can be played. And it's kind of my baby, so it's on my plate. And so it's probably never going to happen.
You didn't tell me you'd gotten pregnant.
Yeah, this is like the 8th time.
Wow.
Let me tell you, given birth through man parts... No picnic.
I can imagine.
Don't.
It's too late. I'm already imagining it.
Well,
it's
your loss.
No. No. Ah. Anyway. So that's kind of the basics of our creative process, how this all works. I hide on my lunch breaks and write a thing, and then I email it to Johannes, and then Johannes is unkind.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sometimes I ignore it for a while.
You ignore things a lot.
I do. And, well, I'm, you know, sometimes you think I'm ignoring things, but really, it's just my crippling ADHD. And I looked at it, and then I forgot about it.
But other things that we found about our creative process, you know, one of the things that was really gratifying when Johanna sent me this article a few times ago that was kind of, so you want to design a board game? Well, here's how you do it, youngin. You whippersnapper with your boots on backward and your milk in your nose and all of these sorts of things. And we were doing most of the things the guy indicated. It was stuff like take the board games you already own and repurpose their components. And we had cannibalized my copy of Settlers of Catan.
Because that's all Settlers of Catan is good for.
You're wrong. And I used right. it in order to prototype a game called Math Wizards, which was a lot of fun, but unfortunately went nowhere. So
you know where yet?
Nowhere yet.
We true. Could always bring it back. Just maybe. Just, probably, I don't know. Just
back it up.
Back it up.
Back it up. Back it up. Back it up. Back it up. Is that a reference to a thing?
I think it's one of those auto-tune the news songs.
Okay. I've never auto-tuned anything.
I know. Tom is tone deaf.
Not well, okay. Confirmedly
He's
true.
He's tone stupid. So our design process.
Yeah, but you know, one of the things I noted too is in that, I think it was one of the Board Game Hour Twitter extravaganzas or in some other article you sent me, a lot of people don't seem to start with a real clear idea of the rules.
Mm-hmm.
Like they start with like an outline or a basic framework and try to playtest from there. We, on the other hand, and this is clearly a mark of our brilliance as men, tend to start with a pretty complete rules document, I think, most of the time.
Complete, if not decipherable by the average human being.
Hmm. Well, that's true. It's not doesn't necessarily make sense if you show it to, say, people.
Yeah, so it was that. It was the Board Game Hour discussion a couple mm-hmm. weeks ago. They talked about rule books, and I was also surprised to see just the number of people who were like, yeah, we get to the rule book eventually. But it's kind of the last thing we do. And it could just be that they do what we do, but they don't consider it a rule book. Because what we start with, we treat like a rule book, but it would need a lot of reformatting and reorganization
That's
before
true.
It was functional true, as yeah. a rule book for people to read out of. It's basically just the guts of the game. But I don't know. It is pretty much what I want out of, or at least the first playthrough section of a rule book. Like, it's pretty chronological. It covers all the bases. And by the time you get to the end of it, you should know how to play the game.
Mm-hmm. I find that when I'm writing those rule books, that this came up in Board Game Hour as well, that it's very handy to do a component list right at the beginning, mm-hmm. just for my sake of thinking, okay, I know I have an idea of what I want to do with this game, mm-hmm. but it helps me to think, okay, I'm going to need 7 dice and 38 cards and 4 tokens, 3 markers, 6 chits, 9 sliders, 3 tweeters, 4 poppers, 11 spinners, and 8 lords a leaping.
Or in the case of Math Wizards, what was it, 100 dice?
Yeah, I think we had 100 tiny dice on that one.
And I think that was after we had toned it down some. We had a lot of dice in Math
Wizards. I think in an early version of Math Wizards, it was just an arbitrary number of dice. The advice was something like, get all of the dice you have. No, wait. I'm afraid you might have misheard me, that you might have heard, give me a lot of dice. What I said was, get all of the dice that you have.
Ding! I listen to another podcast where whenever they reference a brand name or a product, they ring a bell.
Mm.
And I had a thought that maybe whenever we steal someone else's joke, we should do the same thing. So,
ding! That joke was a reference to Parks and Recreation. Parks and Recreation, on at 8, 7 Central on ABC.
Except not anymore, because the last episode already happened.
And I think that was the wrong network.
Yeah, it was.
Okay. Glad we had this talk.
It was very important.
Deeply, deeply critical to the process here. But no, we do tend to put together a component list pretty early, I think. And we tend to put together a rules document pretty early. And I think for a board game, that's pretty important because that's really all there is, are the components and the rules. And if there's not something you can go to while you're playtesting and say, this is what we've decided at this point is what the game is, you don't really have anything. And I think without that kind of structure to it, it's very easy during the playtest to fudge stuff and to wind up playtesting the game that you understand it to be, but not the actual game as you've communicated it out.
Yeah.
Or to wind up playtesting multiple versions, I'm making air quotes, of the game without really realizing it because you're just fudging enough stuff in your heads as you play that it doesn't really, you know, you don't get consistent playtesting.
Yeah. Or the other side of that is that if you write out a rule book first thing, you might end up kind of not making changes that you should because it's in the rules, and either, you know, maybe it's too much work to go back and edit it, or maybe, well, let's just leave it the way it is for now and come back to it later. And then you forget because that's how you do things. You just forget. You forget the things that you said you were going to do all the time. You forget all of them.
And then you don't do them.
And then they don't happen. And then you have the same game that you had before the last 8 play tests, except for the point where you go, oh, there's an asterisk there. We were going to change something. We'll do that later. And you continue not doing it until you get so mad at this game that you give up on it.
Is that what happened to Math Wizards?
No, I think Math Wizards had some real problems, because we've gone back to it at least once since then and tried to do a ground-up redesign and given up on it again.
I tried to turn it into a wheat-based resource management game, and you wouldn't have any part of that.
Go figure.
So that's one part of our design process, is create the rule book early. I would be a strong advocate for write your rules early. Even if they're bad, write them, and then you can print them off with your laser printer or your desk jet or your dot matrix device, yeah. And you can scrawl in the margins, do all kinds of changes.
Carve them into a clay tablet.
No, that's too hard to make updates to. That's like a real permanent thing. You don't do that till you're ready to sell. Come on, man. We talked about this.
Listen, you're the creative one, and I tell you what you did wrong. I can't come up with ideas on my own.
Anyway, another thing that I have found useful in the creative process, and that Johannes may or may not find as useful as I do, is to really take a close look at the numbers behind your game. And I do this with Excel spreadsheets because it's a good way to make it look like I'm working. I mean, it's because they're useful for that. But, you know, I mean, if you've got a key thing that needs to happen in order for the play to proceed, like you need to roll a 5 or better on a 6-sided dice in order for the game to progress, in order for the players to succeed at something, it behooves you to know approximately how often that will happen. Like out of how many, if you roll X number of die rolls, how many of them would you expect in an average game to come up that way?
Mm-hmm.
And so you can roughly estimate, well, if I need to roll a 5 or better and I'm only rolling once a turn, you know it's going to take a while over the course of many games for that to happen. But if you're rolling, you know, 10 dice a turn, it's not going to take so long at all. And so having that kind of grasp of the probability of your game, even if it's maybe not formal, like you can't, might not be able to run the math, but you've at least got an idea of what it looks like, and being able to put those numbers down and think about them, I think is particularly useful.
Tom's much better with the numbers than I am, having less ADD than I do. I actually appreciate a lot of what you do with Excel because the balance is important, and I just don't care enough to push through it. So when we are developing card, especially when we're developing Big Man, where one card does everything in the game, A card is a dungeon tile. A card is your movement speed and your attack and your everything else. The balance of that kind of makes my head spin. And just the thought of trying to sit out and hack it out numbers-wise, I'm just like, nope, I guess we're not going to design board games then. Just we're not going to do that because I'm not doing that. But it is important, and the balance is important, and I'm sure everyone out there has played games where the balance doesn't quite work, and you're like, you end up with this card in hand, and you've pretty much won the game, or, you know, I've had games where everything is crap because the cards just don't quite balance out, or it didn't shuffle right. Any shuffle should shuffle right, and you should be able to work it out. So that's pretty helpful, and I have not seen a recommendation from any other game designers for a better tool than Excel for doing that. That seems to be, you know, if you're going to do numbers balancing, a big old honking spreadsheet seems to be the way to go.
Yeah, it takes some time, but I would encourage other designers to spend some time at it, of looking at those probabilities. How likely are your critical cards to come up? What are people likely to have at any given point in the game? How likely is it for things to pop up? Because really what you're thinking about as a game designer, I mean, you are considering the total set of all of the games that are going to be played, you know, from the time you release your game to the time people forget about it.
Right.
And you're thinking, how many of those games do I want to be successful? How often do I want the right tools to come into the player's hands to accomplish whatever my goal is? How often in Arkham Horror do I want the Ancient One to just, you know, ruin you? Do I want this particular mythos that's incredibly hard to come up, compared to how often do I want the ones that are a little bit easier or even potentially beneficial to pop up?
Mm-hmm.
What's that balance I want to strike there? How hard do I want it to be? Out of, you know, say every 10 games of Arkham, how many should they have a really monstrous nightmare time of? And how many should they have? It's pretty easy. It's pretty straightforward what we need to do here.
And the decision that they seem to have come to is that 100% of the time it should be a nightmare.
Yeah, it should be bad. Because it's Lovecraft. Yeah,
it makes sense.
Yeah. Pause.
You're good.
Oh, I have to make dog water.
Okay.
I gotta make dog water. Can we pause the podcast?
I'm not going to pause it. I'm just going to let it run. Just go do your thing.
Really have to pee. Real bad. Feel free to use any of that that you need.
Oh, I certainly will. As a ringtone and... We're back. No, but really, we're back.
Oh, we are actually back?
I forget what we were talking about.
We were talking about spreadsheets.
Okay.
Doing that and running those kind of numbers, you can preempt the min-maxer player type that we talked about last week a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you know what the dominant strategies are, what the stuff that's going to happen frequently is, or the stuff that's going to happen infrequently, but that's going to be particularly powerful, you know what that person is going to be gravitating toward, and you can tone it down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Two, if you know the scales that you're working at on any given number. For example, if you know that, or if you know ahead of time, say that health for a character only runs from a starting value of 6 to 10, mm-hmm. 6 being your low end, 10 being your high end, you know a few things about what that min-max player is going to be looking for at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And by laying that out in a real neat grid that you can look at and see and manipulate a little bit, you can kind of preempt some of that stuff and make some intelligent, informed decisions about what you're doing.
Yeah, so at this point, we'll have sat and spitballed ideas at one another, come up with a concept.
Spitballed regular spitballs, too.
Yeah, probably. Hacked together some semblance of a rule book. Now, we, knowing what components we are, balanced stats or cards or whatever it is that we're working with, and now we're pretty much ready to start making any components that we can't repurpose from other games.
Yeah, and usually that's just a pretty straightforward, like, OpenOffice draw or Visio file, just a little vector graphics. We do a lot of card games
mm-hmm.
Because they're the easiest thing I've found to draw. Like, drawing hexes is a real pain in the neck, and printing them and then cutting them out, that's a real...
Yeah.
I don't want to do that. But cards are pretty straightforward to do. So you draw them up, you put the text, and you keep it as simple as possible because it doesn't have to look pretty at this point. And then you print it out, and then you try to use a paper cutter to cut it out
without cutting off a finger,
and then you make a mistake and there's blood everywhere and you've cut a corner off one of the cards and now you have to start over, and it's just why did you surprise me right when I was moving down the lever on the paper cutter. Why did you do that? Get me a bandage.
It was absolutely intentional, and I will not get you a bandage.
Yeah, and so there's blood spraying out, and you're chasing each other around the facility, and it's a difficult time.
But fun, for me.
For you.
Yeah. Yeah.
For me, it wasn't so much. I lost a lot of blood that day.
Eventually, Tom passes out. Then maybe I'll get him a bandage.
So you print out your stuff. You eventually print out your second copy and cut it out carefully this time.
Yeah.
Keeping your fingers out from under the blades. And then you playtest it. You just playtest it a lot. You just, every week, instead of playing new and exciting games that you bought from the game store and that have all sorts of shiny, nice components, you play your prototype game until your friends don't like you anymore.
Which for us didn't take a lot of time, because I don't think they liked us all that much to begin with.
Yeah, really, I don't understand why Gary or Alphonse even hangs out with
us. I don't know either. And especially when it's a game like Math Wizards was originally. We're like, no, we promise it'll be good eventually. Just place another hex and roll 38 dice.
Hold on. I need to consult against the table to see how your roll went. It'll take me a few minutes. It's a complicated table. I have to input the total that you rolled into the spreadsheet and see what pops out.
You need to be a licensed actuary to actually manage a game of Math Wizards.
It's kind of a Cones of Dunshire situation. Math Wizards, coming to a retailer near you, spring 2016?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, whatever. But no, playtesting a lot is particularly important. I'm actually general of the opinion at the moment that playtesting where you're not there or where you're silent is not as valuable.
Have we done that more than once?
I don't think we've done that more than once, no.
Okay.
But people will say, like, you should playtest and you should be out of the room. Or you should playtest, but you shouldn't say anything. I don't agree. I think you should be quiet as much as you can, but if there's an obvious place to interject, interject. If there's clearly a place where you just f***ed up the rule book, just chime in and say, this is what I meant by that phrase. My bad.
Well, I think there is a value to it, and I think it'll depend on the group of players that you have playtesting. Because if you're not there, and you have a fairly flexible group of people playing, and they come across a rule they can't figure out, they're just going to try to figure it out so they can keep playing the game, because you're not there to talk to. Mm-hmm. And they may figure out what you meant, or they may come up with something different, and what they come up with might be better. And so if you can look at, like, if you can do what we tried to do and have, you know, a video recorder running in the room where they're playtesting and watch it later, and they come up with something that's actually better than what you had in the first place, mm-hmm. score. You just came up with something much better, or they came up with something much better, but you just greatly improved your game more than just making your rules readable. You just made your game a better game. And I'm not saying that's going to happen a lot of the time, but I think the chance that it happens is pretty good.
I suppose, yeah. I can see it.
Part of the reason that we playtest rule books like that and do blind playtests is because we know the game from the ground up. We've built it, we've designed it, we've done everything. And so it's all in our heads, but it's all in our heads, including stuff that we decided wasn't worth keeping in the game earlier. But that's still floating around in there. And so we're much more likely, if we come up against the rule that doesn't work or a mechanic that we don't like, to go back to something that worked before, rather than having no reference of what to go back to, just come up with something totally new. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of value in blind playtesting, whether or not you're there. And depending on the people, your being there may make them much less likely to come up with something interesting than it, you know, if you're sitting there saying, well, I can answer your question as soon as it pops up into your head.
Yeah, it makes sense. Okay, I'll give you that point.
It's more time consuming, but what mm-hmm. are you going to do?
Playtest your game. That's what I'm going to do.
Well, your game is my game because we design games together.
Yeah. It's a beautiful friendship. So you playtest a whole bunch? Like a lot?
Yeah.
Until it's the way you want it to be, I guess. I guess the other thing I would point out is that at this stage of the game, it's easy to get locked in. At least I found that it's easy to get locked into, you know, we've done it this way, this is the game we've made, and it you know, kind of get that kind of tunnel vision on it. I'm mm-hmm. making kind of a tunnel vision gesture with my hands right now.
He's being very careful not to touch the microphone or the stand. I'm very proud of him. He's learning.
I'm an adult. but, you know, don't hesitate at that stage of the game to just throw literally everything out and start over from the very hairiest beginning of the process.
Yeah.
Like with our game Big Man, we had been working on it for a little over a year, I think.
Yeah.
At that point. And then I just wrote, we just made a new one. It was just new, and it had all kinds of new mechanics and crazy stuff in it. There was a dog.
There was no dog.
Other dogs. It was just Big Man, Dog Edition.
That's not even a little bit true. But Tom did ground up change every single card, which, again, as we mentioned before, means all the dungeon tiles are different, and all of the stats are different, and there were some new items and some vastly overpowered stuff and some pretty interesting new stuff, and we're going to keep some of it, and we're not going to keep other parts of it, but it was a very useful exercise.
In redoing everything that you'd already done once before.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're actually in the process of doing that a third time right now.
Yep.
It's just torch everything, burn it to the ground, throw away all of your notes, all of your tools, find your playtesters, take them into the woods.
Shoot them.
Bury them in a shallow grave, hit at least 3 feet, but you don't have to go all the way to 6. And then start again. Start from scratch. Go to Montana.
In a new town, in a new state.
New identity.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's how we do it.
That's how Mildly Alarming Games rolls.
17 years, not one game release.
So now we get to the part of the game design process that we actually don't know anything about.
We have zero experience.
Which is the part where you either create a game yourself and sell it in a saleable, like, package that could be shrink-wrapped and that a merchant would be not ashamed to stock in his or her establishment.
Mm-hmm.
Or you contact a game publisher such as Fantasy Flight or Indie Board and Card or other publishers that I'm going to name drop in the hope that they listen to my podcast and pick it up.
Whoever will take your sad sack attempt at a game design with no artwork.
Yeah, exactly. And then they do all the hard part that you don't understand because you're a half-wit.
Mm-hmm.
And then they sell it and they cut you a big fat check and then you retire to Maui.
Or a tiny sad check. We don't know yet.
Yeah, we have no idea what the board game money looks like. So we have no idea how that part of the process works, other than that we're very scared of it.
And in fact, if you happen to be a successful board game designer, which given the people who we relate to on Twitter and the internet, it's probably more likely than not at this point. And you have pointers for us fledgling game design idiots. About, you know, that sort of thing. Please let us know. Please. Oh God, please let us know.
I cannot overemphasize how little we know about this part. Basically, our game plan for board game publishing at this point is that we want to meet a person who is good at business and also at making stuff that people would pay money for. And that person will do that part. And all we have to do is lock ourselves in a little room. Like, it's a small room. It has a mini fridge in it full of food and beer.
And gin.
And gin.
And tonic.
And it's got, like, a mail slot on the one of the walls. And we just make a game in there. And then we push it through the slot. And then later, that person I mentioned before pushes money back through that slot to us.
You know, so there's a hole in this plan. A flaw, if you will.
What's missing?
What do we do with the money in the room? You just described prison. Except we get paid and there's beer, so a little bit better than prison, but not a lot.
It's pretty good. That sounds like a pretty good deal to me.
Yeah, okay. You're not wrong.
Yeah, so if any of you can hook us up with that kind of a setup, please.
Yeah, if you wanna have us in board game slavery for the rest of our lives. I mean, I guess that's paid slavery, but it's only so paid. If you snuck in into the cell where we live in the middle of the night and took the money back, frankly, I can't count. So Tom's the only one who would notice, and he would only notice if you gave him an Excel spreadsheet to keep track of it. So,
and really only then if I remember to put conditional formatting to flag it for me.
Yeah, you would spend more time. You're gonna end up being one of those people who uses Excel to make like patterns for knitting.
I drew the American flag once.
Yeah, Excel. Exactly.
But I didn't just like draw. I didn't go like this cell is blue, this cell is red. I wrote a formula to give each cell an appropriate value from I think it was 0 to 2, and then I conditional formatted the spreadsheet to make the cells the appropriate color based on their value.
Yeah.
So it could look at the row and the column number, and it would give the cell a value based on that, and then it would colorize based on that value. So it was all automatic.
Did it have those the tassels that some flags have? Did you get like a nice gold border?
No, it was kind of it was a small flag.
Yeah, this is the exciting stuff that people tune into podcasts to hear about.
Talking about my Excel spreadsheet American flag drawn.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's the stuff.
Speaking of the American flag, did I tell you that I might have to work on the freaking 4th of July this year?
What?
Oh, I'm not work. I'm on call, though. Like, I might have to go in and, like, do my job the 4th.
Nope. Quit your job.
I'm strongly considering it.
You better.
All right. So board game design process. Anything else we have to say on that topic?
Not really, which as we listen to other board game designers podcasts and stuff, we'll probably find out later is deeply embarrassing.
It's probably not very good.
No. So if you know anything about this sort of thing, let us know. You can hit us up on Twitter at Mildly Alarming. You can leave a comment on the website at mildlyalarming.com, or you can send us an email at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
Do you remember to check that address?
I check it like every 38 seconds every day.
Because I forgot the password.
Yeah. One of us will see your comment.
Or just write your comment on a crisp $20 bill and slide it through the mail slot into our Nightmare Games purgatory, and we'll get back to you.
Oh, Nightmare Games would have been a good game company name. It's probably taken.
It's a little too gothy for me.
But yeah, but if you live in a horrifying 9x9x9 concrete cell with like a wrought iron door with a mail slot in it, maybe it's not.
It's not so inaccurate. Yeah. Listen, man. We are dear friends. We have known each other a long time. I'm going to need at least 12 by 12 before I'm going to share a room with you.
And a shower. Preferably in another room.
Not just like a hose that the other guy has to use to spray you down.
No soap. You just get all wet and then that's it. You're wet now.
There's no towels.
That's clean, right?
Yeah, sure.
Gross.
No towel, though. You just have to air dry.
Well, we'll be back after I'm done vomiting.
The Mildly Alarming Podcast is brought to you by the Wayne Crothman Institute of Technology. At Wayne Crothman, we'll pour scalding hot soup into your cupped hands. Active hostility to our students and community? That's the Wayne Crothman difference. The Wayne Crothman Institute of Technology. You're gonna feel a little pinch.
In the break there, we were having a conversation about the books that we used to read.
When we were children.
When we were children and in high school, which is still children, but even though it was 10 years ago, I don't feel that way.
So old!
And we made the comment several times that we should have the mics running while this is going on. So we're going to go for it, and maybe this will be interesting, and maybe it won't. But
it won't.
Here we go.
But we were talking about how different fantasy novels, how explicit they can be in their scenes of a copulatory nature. You know, when eventually the dwarves and the hobbits start to bump uglies.
Oh no.
You
no
know,
one wants that. How much, hairy feet and hairy faces.
It's just that's how you get a Wookiee.
Why are they tall?
Well, short. It's like when you multiply a negative number by a negative number and you get a positive.
That's Tom is the one of the two of us who is good at math. Good God.
Yeah. You made a midget with a midget, you get a giant, right?
Wow.
That's how science works. But anyway, we were talking about exactly how detailed different novels get, different fantasy stories get, when they describe their hot dwarf on halfling action. And it was interesting in a little bit because, like, a lot of them don't. Like, Lord of the Rings, presumably some stuff was going on because nobody had gone extinct.
Right.
But, like, I don't remember Tolkien ever describing his character's erogenous zones in any way, shape, or form.
Right, like, Sam had a baby before the end of the book, right?
Many babies.
Right, and, like, you know, we never once knew how precisely in the heat of the moment in the bedroom that night. It happened.
Yeah, we didn't get that description.
Why? But then there are other authors who may have HBO television shows based on their series of books who take a very different tack when it comes to, you know, bedrooms or apparently not bedrooms, maybe church altars. Who frickin' knows?
See, this is funny because I have actually read A Grunt of Thrusts.
I read some of it. Really? I thought I finished it, but I don't retain books the same way you do.
Ah, yeah, that's fair. Yeah, so we were talking about Game of Thrones there, which I refer to in my head as Grunt of Thrusts.
We also, I believe, used to refer to the series as Knights Who Say F***.
We stole that one from Crack.com.
Oh, though, did
too.
We? Really?
We did. That one
did Crack.com exist at that time?
In like 2000, when?
2000 high school?
I don't know that we were reading it, but I remember, I'm about 84% sure we stole Knights Who Say F*** in like the 2007 range, because I think I read that article in college.
Okay.
It definitely existed in 2007.
Okay. At any rate, yeah, you were saying something about a grunt of thrust.
A grunt of thrust. I was just pointing out that the altar on which the humping occurred was in that novel.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert, by the way. There's going to be a lot of spoilers up
in
this
business.
Yeah,
that's a real big spoiler. There was humping.
Yeah, there was a lot of weird, freaky sex and violence in Game of Thrones.
Go
spoiler
figure.
Spoiler alert!
So
I wish I hadn't done that.
We all do.
But, you know, it's... We were thinking back, too, to books we'd read specifically when we were childers, and probably our parents are going to listen to this podcast and think, good Lord, we really should have paid more attention to what these little bastards were reading.
It's a good thing they don't have time machines.
I'm hoping they also don't call us bastards, because that would kind of imply...
That's awkward, yeah.
Some stuff, yeah?
Yeah.
So, like, I'm remembering the Mythgar novels of Dennis L. McKiernan, who I emailed once, and who emailed me back, actually.
Yeah?
A long time ago.
Leave me alone, you little freak?
No, he was actually very nice.
Oh, that was nice of him. That's
like,
what I said whenever you talked to me, and we were friends.
I know, it's true. No, I was like, I really like your books, and I'm trying to write my own, and he's like, that's great. It's pretty much the exchange.
I love the idea that he sent you a two-word, just, that's great. You're 12, hopefully this won't destroy you.
I'm not sure he's still alive.
Yeah?
Well, he was like he fought in the Korean War, so he's pretty old by now.
He's not a young guy.
Yeah. He hasn't written anything in a while either that I know of.
Yeah, so I was shocked to learn, because I never read any of them, that R.A. Salvatore was writing family-friendly stuff. I assumed that pulpy sci-fi fantasy was pretty down and dirty, because that was my limited experience.
But the thing is that, you know, you're talking pulpy sci-fi fantasy, and then you're also talking pulpy sci-fi fantasy put out by Wizards of the Coast,
sure,
a wholly owned subsidiary of Hasbro.
Is it really?
Yeah, Hasbro owns WotC.
I had no idea.
So it all reflects back on the master brand,
mm-hmm,
and so it all has to behave itself to one or another. I don't remember there ever being any weird sex going on,
mm-hmm,
in the R.A. Salvatore Drizzt novels. I actually just recently finished the novels, the Forgotten Realms books by Aaron M. Evans about...
You just recently finished them?
Yeah, recently as in like December.
Wow, okay. I didn't think you were reading that stuff.
No, I downloaded them on a whim. I was just like, I want to read some straightforward fantasy where I'm not worried about symbolism or anything. I just want, occasionally some orcs are going to get f***ed up.
Sure.
And so I downloaded this author named Aaron M. Evans. She wrote a series of novels about a tiefling warlock named...
We got to clear this up right now. There is no... There's no language where T-I-E is tie. Sorry, no, that's not even a little bit true. There is no language where T-I-E-F is tife. It is tiefling. Tiefling. If it were tiefling, it would be T-E-I. Tiefling. We're putting this on the internet for all to hear now. Tiefling.
So she wrote lady Aaron M. Evans wrote this series of novels about a tiefling, because apparently Johannes is going to poop himself if we pronounce it the other way. Warlock, and her sister, who is a fighter, because we got to use D&D classes here.
Right.
And their gay dragonborn dad, spoiler alert.
Are they adopted?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that they're adopted.
That makes more sense.
Yeah. And like, there's some sex content in there, but it's pretty tame.
Yeah.
Like, it's of the, we're going to get right up to the moment where it's clear that there are, she's about to bump uglies with her fiendish warlock patron, because this is some classy shit right here.
Right.
And then we're going to smash cut to the next chapter, and we're going to talk about the paladin instead.
It's like the sex chapter in The Hitchhiker's Guide. Not the original first book of The Hitchhiker's Guide, but The Hitchhiker's Guide.
Right.
Quadrilogy or whatever it is. That was actually, even when I first read that in freshman year of high school, even that was a little...
You're talking about in So Long and Thanks for All the Fish, right?
Yeah.
Where it's him and Fenchurch.
Like, he begins with, you know, if you're offended by this sort of thing, skip this chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, how does it act? He phrased it exactly.
He goes on this long, like multi-paragraphs long tirade about Arthur Dent.
Yeah.
And then he sums it up with, does he not in a nutshell?
In a nutshell. That's the part I always forget. Yeah. And even that was a little bit on the, I won't say raunchy, but more than I was expecting side.
From Douglas Adams.
From Douglas Adams.
Well,
yeah.
But two, it's not, it's, You're left in no doubt what they're up to.
Right.
But it's also plenty is left to the imagination in that they're flying at the time.
They're
because
flying,
you can
and
do
so
that.
Pretty much all of it is left to the imagination.
Yeah, more or less. And like you get, he mentions some, quote, scraps from Marx and Spencer fluttering down away from the pair of them as they fly through the
right,
sky.
And I did not live anywhere at the time when this was written, I don't think. I think So Long and Thanks for All the Fish was pre-87.
I don't remember, but while you talk, I'll look it up.
I certainly had not lived in the UK at the time when this was written, but my experience of what scraps from Marx and Spencer could mean extends from anywhere between bedclothes to clothing articles, which would he probably meant to, you know, like food. Marx and Spencer food was kind of a big deal. Advertising
really?
Wise when I was living in Northern Ireland at
oh
any
gotcha
rate.
gotcha.
Yeah, so
also,
you know,
84.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, I definitely wasn't alive. But, yeah, scraps from Marks and Spencer, you can figure out what that means. But, you know, it could also mean, like, banana peels. Maybe they were having a sky picnic. Who knows?
Incidentally, I never lived in the UK at all. I've never even been to those aisles, and I don't know that they're real.
I've been lying to you all these years.
Makes sense. I don't remember ever being confused by that phrase. I'm like,
yeah,
okay.
No, I wasn't confused by
okay,
it. I'm
gotcha,
just
gotcha,
saying,
gotcha.
Now... that phrase means, you know, less maybe than it had at
fair
the
enough.
Time.
And two, if I recall that scene correctly, it's been a while since I've read it, so dear readers, do correct me if I'm wrong. But
they're listeners. We're not writing.
No, they're readers. Everything is reading.
Everything is reading.
Yeah. But there's then a little bit where...
we're going to release a Mildly Alarming podcast t-shirt that just has Mildly Alarming logo on it and the sentence, everything is reading.
Can we make that shirt?
Yeah, I think
all right,
we can.
Sweet. But there's a bit shortly after that where the two are flying around, having shed the scraps from Marks and Spencer, and it cuts from a viewpoint focused on them to a viewpoint focused on this lady who is on a plane. And she's like a middle-aged lady who's had a life and whatnot, and it's kind of talks about her ennui at this stage of her life. And then she sees them more or less, you know, baby-making on the wing of the plane. And it doesn't explicitly state what she sees, but it talks about how she reacts to it. And you're like, okay, I kind of get what's going on as a result of that description. So in some ways, Douglas Adams, by being not at all explicit about these sex scenes, create something far and away more memorable than he would have had he just been like, and then they boinked.
Yeah, I don't think I would have any recollection of that chapter if it had been a, like even an explicit description of what they did, or a more dancing around the subject avoidance of what they did.
Well, I mean, that book, I think you mentioned it a few minutes ago, that Planet Pirates book you read in middle school.
Yeah, this was co-authored by someone I can't remember and someone else whose name I can't remember, but who wrote the Dragon Riders of Pern series of novels.
That's not Mercedes Lackey, I think.
It is Mercedes. No,
is it?
No, it's not. You're
it's
right.
It's not Tamora Pierce. Mercedes Lackey. There's a third very famous woman who wrote fantasy novels whose name is escaping me at the moment. Keep talking about it. I'll look it up.
I have literally nothing else to talk about, but I guess I can fill the space. The Planet Pirates book he's talking about was actually a three-part, but I don't think it was ever released in three parts. I think it was always one.
Anne McCaffrey,
that's right. I think it was always one, like, 900-and-something page monstrosity. Does it say who the other author is?
I looked up Dragon Riders of Pern, not Planet Pirates.
Go ahead and look up Planet Pirates while I babble incessantly. It had what I considered at the time to be fairly explicit scenes of lovemaking. And in retrospect, it was not all that explicit. Like,
and I think the only reason either of us really remembers it is that I can remember being in like the fifth grade and you were like, look at this page of Planet Pirates. And you're like, pointing out the grody scenes in there to me. And I'm like,
right, we're in the very beginning of middle school and what even is happening in this book?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Also, the other two authors...
Did you know that people did that?
I'm like,
grown-ups do this.
Oh my goodness.
Gross.
Oh my stars and girders.
Boobies.
But the other two authors were Elizabeth Moon and Jody Lynn Nye.
Oh, I didn't know there were three. I remember Jody Lynn Nye. I don't remember the other author didn't even have her name on the front of the book.
Yeah. Planet Pirates is a science fiction trilogy written by Anne McCaffrey and two co-authors separately, Elizabeth Moon and Jody Lynn Nye.
Yeah, Elizabeth Moon, you really missed out on the credit there. Oh. Fifth graders.
You know what? It looks like they didn't all three write all three novels of it, so I wonder if they weren't all credited on the copy you have.
Could be.
Because it looks like McCaffrey and Moon wrote Sassenach, and then McCaffrey and Nye wrote The Death of Sleep, and then McCaffrey and Moon wrote Generation Warriors.
Oh, so it sounds like Moon had more to do than Jody Lynn Nye.
And yet you don't remember
her.
And
yet her name is not on the front of the book that encompasses all three volumes.
Yeah, I don't understand that.
Yeah, you got shafted, somebody, Moon.
Elizabeth.
Whatever, it doesn't matter. You're not important. The publishers have decided you weren't important, and thus it is the case.
But, yeah. So that was an explicit sex scene that we remember, but, like, not because of its explicitness, but more because of the time in our lives that we read it.
Yeah.
Similarly, I read all of the Dennis L. McKiernan Mythgar novels multiple times because I was a cool kid.
Yeah, so cool.
And, like, they had some raunch to them in a few places. But the only reason I remember it is because some kid was reading over my shoulder one day while I was shirking my homework. And he's like, why do you read that kind of stuff, Tom? And I'm like, because screw you, Ryan. Don't freaking read over my shoulder, you dick.
Yeah, people named Ryan.
Yeah. Yeah, so if your name is Ryan, I'm not your friend. That's not true.
It's probably, are you friends with anyone named Ryan?
Oh, the guy at work that I work with.
You know what? Oh, right, Ryan.
You would know him as Rhino Crocodile.
I do know him as Rhino Crocodile. Yeah. I guess that's okay.
Yeah. I don't think he listens to the podcast, so it's probably fine.
It seems unlikely.
I told him about it.
Yeah?
Yeah. He's never expressed any interest in hearing it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't. I don't even listen to these when you send them to me to review.
I hope you die. I could post them right away otherwise. Why do you make me suffer so?
You just answered your question. But, you know, I think... I think that notion, that subtlety in your smuttier scenes of your epic fantasy novels and your sci-fi novels is better, is one that more writers should take to heart. I think the Harlequin romances and these things have poisoned our youth. And I'm making noise now. Please,
yeah, really.
Please save me from where I'm going with this.
I don't entirely disagree with what you have to say, though. I think the difference between Harlequin romance novels and, you know, sci-fi fantasy or whatever else you read has its place. And maybe, you know, if you need a sex scene to happen in your book, really consider if it needs to be a sex scene or if it just needs to say, do they not, in a nutshell. And then move on with the story that we're actually reading your book to learn about and experience.
So the real question is not so much exactly, precisely, in intimate detail, how do various hoo-has and ding-dongs interact with one another?
Mostly the same way, like, as I understand it.
Well, yeah, but I mean, okay, I guess the hoo-ha and the ding-dong are going to interact in pretty much the same way, but, like, what orientation are the people when they interact?
Yeah, yeah.
And, like... I don't know.
Are they upside down in space?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. All of that stuff. And more, how does the interaction of hoo-ha and ding-dong interact or reveal what sort of people these are? And how does that further impact the broader story about the human condition that you're telling?
Right. If you're telling a story that it really is hoo-has and ding-dongs are important to the story, great. You know, tell it in detail. I'm not reading that book, and so it's not going to catch me off guard. If you are telling a story about how the dwarves are overcoming the rock elementals or whatever that rule the top of the mountain in your world that
you've
created. Sounds
like a fucking awesome book.
Right? I might write it just later when we're done here. It'll take me about 13 minutes. I'm a fast typist. And suddenly you have, like, a love interest that's been a side story, and you feel you need to take a chapter to tell us about how they do the sideways shuffle. Maybe edit that chapter out because it doesn't have any effect on the rock elementals, and they're the ones we're interested in.
Or edit it down at least. You could have your glorious dwarf warlord, who is the best dwarf fighter lady. Because we're egalitarian up in this hobby.
Yeah, why not?
She beats up a bunch of rock elementals and she comes home to her husband, who has been busily repairing her armor all day because he's a smith.
Right.
And they have a deeply mutual relationship where
Gary, he's a smith.
Yeah, Gary's a smith. And then you end the chapter with them, like, making eyes at each other, kind of. Like I'm raising my eyebrows at Johannes right now.
Yeah, he is. It's cute.
He's super pumped now.
If we weren't both married to other people, I would probably, you know, have a flop sweat and leave, because as nerds, that's how we deal with women when they flirt with us. If they flirt with, they don't flirt with us. It doesn't happen.
It's true. You know, and then, you know, you end it on the bedroom eyes and everybody's like, yeah, we know what they did. We know how that went down. Or you start the chapter with them entangled in the sweaty sheets.
Or here's an idea. Have the whole chapter explaining what happens in gory detail.
Why is it gory? What did they do?
You don't need to know. And just let me finish.
Sorry.
It's written in Dwarvish. Whatever Dwarvish language you made up. It's like, listen, if you took the time to learn the Dwarvish language I invented for my fantasy universe, you get to experience the nasty that happens in this chapter. And otherwise, you're like, well, I guess that's like 30 pages I get to skip.
All I can think of is Elijah Wood in The Fellowship of the Ring saying, what is the Elvish word for friend? But he's saying, what is the Dwarvish word for c**k?
Good God.
And there we just lost both of our parents as listeners.
Yeah, so before we get any worse than we already have, if you enjoyed this sort of nonsensical BS kind of, cackling, drunken conversation and want more of it, let us know. And if you don't, we don't care. We're going to keep doing it. But hit us up.
It's not like you're real anyway, dear listener.
Hit us up on Twitter at Mildly Alarming. By email at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com or in the comments section at www.mildlyalarming.com. And if you're looking for a different way to listen to our show, or, you know, you accidentally stumble across it, we're also on Stitcher. Maybe one day we'll be on iTunes, but we're not yet because I can't bring myself to install it on my computer.
You can also reach us by smoke signal at Big Puff, Little Puff, Big Puff, Big Puff, Big Puff, Little Puff.
If you have a big enough blanket.
If you have a big enough blanket, true. Good night, everybody.
Good night. The Mildly Alarming podcast is produced on machinery that is used to process peanuts and may contain traces of peanut oil.